Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kavi Kavusi, and I'll be discussing a diverse array of subjects that span from my experiences in the emergency room to the furthest reaches of the universe. I'll be hosting guests, inviting illuminating conversations that at times may challenge ways of thinking or being, while also nurturing curiosity, meaning, and awe into life. Please consider subscribing, liking, saving, or sharing this podcast with any of your friends or family if it feels right for you. Thank you for taking the time. Let's dive into the podcast. My guest on this episode is Tristan De Montebello, one part of the project Ultra Speaking, alongside his incredible business partner and friend, Michael Gendler. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. I met them at a men's retreat in 2018 that was being hosted up north, 2 hours north of Toronto. And they were brought to help us speak before we think. And it was really well executed, and it taught me a different level of walking up onto the stage and trusting that I already know what is to be said there. Tristan shares his story of how he woke up one day and wanted to compete to become the number one public speaker in America. He shares how he realized that this is a challenge that's not unique to him, and now there are many individuals around the world who seek their services in order to become better public speakers. It is intriguing to note that among the greatest fears that human beings have, including spiders or fear of heights or whatever it may be, even having challenging conversations, fear of public speaking ranks among the top, so much so that some people consider death to be less fearful than public speaking. There's something there, and Tristan and Michael explore it really beautifully, but Tristan is here to speak about it. And so enjoy the podcast as much as I did, especially this was my inaugural podcast recording while I was down in California seeing them for a moment. Enjoy.
Epstein didn't kill himself.
We'll keep all of the political things to natural flow, but until there's concrete aspects to the story, we'll just dance in it. So this is the first recording that I'm doing with Tristan Montebello. Is it De Montebello?
It's De Montebello.
De Montebello. And we're here in Los Angeles, and I'll probably do a little introduction. But in short, I met Tristan in March at a retreat in Toronto. And he, alongside a beautiful man by the name of Michael, who's actually looking at us right now. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Taught us a little talent that is so beneficial for us, and we all would love to tap into, but we had the opportunity to be immersed in their art that they stumbled upon. And I got to know these guys over the past, I guess, 7.5-8 months in brief periods here and there, but we've always been dancing in the periphery. But their work that happened in March was a big catalyst for the processes that I've been through. So I got the opportunity last week to go to Hawaii, and Tristan was there, and we got to work through his process again. And being in LA, I thought this would be a great opportunity for us to tap in and share some of your wisdom, your art, and what you guys happen to just stumble upon with the audience. So I would, without further ado, this is Tristan De Montebello. And hey, Tristan.
Hey, Kaveh. Hey, I'm brother. Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks, man. We're in a theater of, it feels like it's got a 1940s vibe with a nice concrete wall, wooden floors. And we've got to be very mindful about how we move. So we got to move. Yeah, we got to think before we move. So why don't you let everyone know a little bit about why you are?
Why I am?
Yeah.
That's deep. Do we have 24 hours? Michael, so my partner in crime, Michael, and I met because I started on this learning project, this learning journey, and the universe wanted something to happen because the first person that really stuck out to me was Michael. I went into a Toastmasters meeting to start speaking, to start getting some reps in, and I saw Michael speak, and I was absolutely blown away. I was blown away for many reasons, but mainly he had a poise and a confidence and a way with words that I'd almost never seen. And he looked like he was 12 years old. I later found out that he was basically 12 years old. He was 26, I think, or 25 at the time. And immediately by the end of that Toastmaster session, I went to see him and I said, "Hey, can you help me out? I'm working on this speaking project." And he graciously accepted, having no idea what he was getting into. But really I just knew that whatever he knew, I needed to know. I wanted that type of freedom. And it led us on this insane, absolutely insane, unexpected journey, the hardest project of my life, where we, with the help of Michael, I competed in the World Championships of Public Speaking. Mm-hmm. And we made it to top 10 to the finals out of whatever, 30,000 people. But that pales in comparison to the impact that project had on my life. And really the reason why we're speaking here today. Mm-hmm. Because in the second half of that journey, Michael really pushed me to go out and speak in situations where I wasn't prepared, where I didn't have a script, where I didn't have a speech. And I had an assistant book speech after speech after speech in front of a new audience. And I just show up there with a few ideas we brainstormed in the morning. And Michael kept pushing me to just trust that my brain's going to come up with something. And he was training me in that, in spontaneity and flow, basically. And that transformed how I walk around on a day-to-day basis. And that's really what we're doing today. We're helping people bring presence, flow, and playfulness to speaking so they can discover for themselves what it feels like to be unlocked and free in the act of speaking, which is almost an oxymoron to many, many people.
Mm-hmm. That's lovely. The name of your project is Ultra Speaking.
Right. Yes.
And the game that they've created is Speak Before You Think. And what compelled me so much is we're living in an age where we recognize that when a human being no longer exists, the only thing that remains is their stories. And we get a lot of stories retroactively after the person has passed. But now in this age where information is being consumed in the way that it is, everyone is striving to tell a story, and we have a tendency to listen more and more to these powerful, compelling storytellers. And when we see that, there's almost this tendency within us that's like, I have a story. I would love to be able to share. And there's a part that maybe is underdeveloped that's like, hear me. But also there's another one that is formulating under that says, I'm slowly integrating my capacity to express a story. I'm integrating what my story even is. And with a tool like yours, there's an opportunity for you to develop the capacity to get out of your own way and really express the truth of your story. Because there's so many times where, for myself, I've been in a moment and I've wanted to share a story, and I do, and I'm just like, oh, that wasn't what I wanted to say. And there is an element of ineffability where you cannot capture all of the words that are necessary to really bring the person to that moment. But you guys have captured all the tools that seem to be available for someone to share the most compelling story that is available to you. So it's interesting also hearing you share this story about this person that had such a beautiful impact, because I'm able to look to my 11 o'clock and see him right there with a beautiful smile on his face. And he does look like they met when he was 26, and now he looks like he's 22.
He's Benjamin Buttoning.
He's Benjamin Buttoning, yeah. So this process, you guys started when?
We met almost 3 years ago.
3 years
and,
ago.
It's been a little over 2 years now, or almost 2 years to the day, that we've been actively coaching, that we've really devoted our lives to helping people feel freedom speaking under pressure.
Right. That's beautiful. So, again, I was in Hawaii this past week with Tristan, and we, among things, did free diving. And Tristan has a particular capacity to push himself to the limits of what a human being is able to endure. For example, he held his breath for 5 minutes, didn't pass out, and came out and was able to throw his arm up in victory. I only made it to a minute and a half and I was gasping for air. So there is a different element that exists between a human being that has the same constituents that make us up that Tristan is able to tap into. And I'm sure there are many other listeners who can tap into this in their own variations as well. But what do you think that is for you? And how do you fine tune that? And maybe how is it applicable to the process that you guys work with?
I love that you're taking this angle because this is something I think about a lot and something that I've integrated in my life a lot. I believe that we all know when we're holding back. If you finish anything and you take a step back and you look, you know if you held back. I know that in holding my breath for whatever it was, 5 minutes and a few seconds, when I came up, I probably had another 10 seconds in me. Now, I don't have the experience to know if those extra 10 seconds would have meant losing motor control and passing out, which is not ideal when you have your head underwater. But I did notice that. But it was a tremendous victory, and I raised my hand in victory, as you said, because the previous time I tried, I hadn't hit 5 minutes. And I knew then that I had let go because of the discomfort of my mind. The difference between holding your breath a minute and a half and holding your breath 3 or 4 minutes is only in your mind. It's a true relationship between your mind and your body and surrender, basically. I noticed something really powerful. As I went underwater the first time holding my breath, let me back up for a sec. Just explain what breath holding really is and why I'm saying that you can double your time. Most people know that, you know, the record holders can hold their breath for 8, 9, 10. I think the record is around 12 minutes. Let's just say somebody can hold their breath for 8 minutes. What almost nobody knows is that for the last four minutes, that person is experiencing contractions in their body, like a kind of like a hiccup motion of your body almost convulsing, asking for air. That's what it feels like. Mm-hmm. And when you hit that moment of anxiety, where the main voice, not the side voice in the back of your mind saying, hey, maybe this, no, the main voice in your brain is saying, you have to breathe or you will die right now. When that rises up, you haven't hit the halfway mark of what you're physiologically able to do in that very moment with no extra training. But that's what's so interesting about this, is that that place, the hardest part is not the end. It's not even the last minute. I actually feel almost as comfortable at minute 4 than I do at minute 1. But at minute 2, 2.5, I feel like I'm going to die. And I remember putting my head underwater and getting to whatever, 2 minutes and before the contractions start and thinking to myself, I hate it here. I want to leave. I don't want to do this. I don't have it in me. But sadly, I knew that I could do it and I didn't want to let go. And I knew that I had to at least get to the contractions before I would allow myself to even consider letting go. And once the contractions started, then you get into a rhythm and you can relax with each one. But, well, I think the reason I could do that is I was just lucky that, or yeah, lucky, I think, that many years ago surfing, I got caught under a very big wave and I was held down long enough that the contractions started and I had no choice but to surrender to them. All I knew from watching big wave surfers and being into that was that in a moment of where you want to breathe, you just have to relax more. So I'm underwater relaxing as much as I can. And I start noticing these contractions and thinking like, all I want is to panic, but I have to relax. And so when I got to actual breath holding and to learning that work, and I discovered that people were getting those contractions for half of the time, there was almost a familiarity to it. So I'm expecting that. But really what it's about, I think, is confronting yourself to the edge. Right? That's what it's about in speaking. When somebody comes in, all they want is to sit down and speak. Well, talk about speaking, right? They want to sit down and say, like, this is what happens and tell me what it feels like to speak. They don't want to speak. When somebody comes to us with a script because they have a 20-minute talk, all they want to do is go over the script with us. They want to sit down and look through the script and, can we change this word? Does this make sense? What we do is we say, let's put the script aside. Please stand up. Michael's going to give you an introduction. You have 5 minutes to give us your 15-minute speech. Please put your hands together for Cave, da 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 da, and boom, the person has to go. Why? Because that's the thing whatever is the scariest in that moment, that edge is where the magic happens. But you have to get the full revolution, right? Once they go through the whole thing, inevitably, every single time, 100% of the time, they sit down, they look at us kind of with a strange look, and they say, wow, I didn't even know I could do that. That was a lot easier than I thought. I actually know what I'm supposed to talk about. And there's something there of having experienced the full revolution, what it feels like to go all the way there and back, that frees something. And that's what I was lucky enough to experience, or unlucky enough to experience, by getting held down underwater in surfing. And the same thing in this speaking. I was thrown into that and I kind of had no choice. Right, I had a speech that was booked. We didn't have anything, and I told Michael, "What do I do right now? I have a speech in 2 hours. We just threw everything away and created this new thing that's half baked. Do I go and give my old speech and just maybe try to work on something different with the old speech that I know by heart, or do I do something else?" And he challenged me. He said, "Well, what would challenge you the most?" Which was the topic of the speech. So I kind of trapped myself in this horrible place. But I went out there and I blanked in the middle of my speech, total blank, 10 seconds. Andrew was there, actually, our friend, mutual friend, in the audience. But I'm walking around the stage with panic in my mind, totally blank, thinking this is exactly what was supposed to happen. This is terrible. I knew it would happen. And I couldn't find what I was supposed to say or what I hoped to say. And then finally I thought, okay, I have to say something. And I just opened my mouth and something came out and it worked. And I kept speaking. And by the end, people came to me and said, that pause was amazing. So powerful. So everything. So again, I was forced past the edge and I had to experience the whole thing. And then I came back and said, oh, so that's what it feels like to take that extra step. That's what it feels like to go a little bit too far. So now I can find balance.
Well, thank you for that beautiful share. Wow. That makes me think over and over again about these barriers that we have within our mind, the resistance and the liberation that exists on the other side of it. And yesterday, actually, when we were in the airport, I was talking to you about, or 2 days ago, about what I'd heard with Brian Chesky and Reid Hoffman, where they have the 10-star experience that they work through as a process to provide the best customer experience that they could have, actually for the person who's listing as well. So they'll take a property. And they'll
circuit Airbnb,
sorry, on Airbnb, and they'll have what's a 3-star experience, okay, 4-star experience, 5, and then they work all the way up to 10. Then suddenly, when they're working at 10, where it's like the periphery, the challenge, it sounds so ridiculous, can't do that whatsoever. Suddenly, a 7-star seems a lot more doable, and
we often sell ourselves short, but what is it on behalf of? It's very often in the name of our monkey mind saying in the name of survival. And that person who's going on stage fears rejection. And to be rejected by the tribe decreases your chance of survival because you can be ostracized. And so we don't speak. But this tool doesn't even allow that opportunity to show itself, and you'll feel it. You'll feel it want to hold on, to tether you back, to make you not express, to not have some variations in your tone. But this opens it up. It cracks it open. And then suddenly that thing that even you believe to be true is not the case. And you have this capacity within yourself that it brings more awareness to your own story. And then suddenly everything is a little bit brighter around you. And if I could share something that was so magical that came from Speak Before You Think, in March, I am in this Fit for Service mastermind. And the person who started it, his name is Aubrey Marcus. And the week before we had been on a call and he expressed something that in internal family systems terms is a protector. And it was a very clear protector, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to share, but I felt a part of me holding myself back from expressing it. And then I felt the resistance. I recognized the resistance and I stepped over, and there was a sense of liberation. But then what happened was I came down to Austin and he asked me on a whim while he's in front of everyone, he was saying, okay, I'm going to introduce the night. You know what? Actually, no. Let's bring Kaveh up on stage. Kaveh has this. And then within I had about 10 seconds from when I was in my chair to go up on stage to express what I had to share. And it was
amazing.
The most powerful Speak Before You Think experience I've ever had. And I looked around and I just started speaking. There was no moment of consideration about what was to come out of my mouth. And I trusted every word, and I was almost a witnesser to the experience that I was having, but I was able to be in it. And I was looking around at everyone while my mouth was still saying words through here. And I came out of it and it was so compelling. And I'd been working on a startup for 5 years at the time. And I said, I never experienced once in that entire journey what I just experienced now. There is something that is on the other side, and I'm too curious to not continue to explore. So I actually walked away from my startup 4 days after that. But your guys, your project, your process of helping us get out of our way was a massive component to the experience that I had that has provided this liberation that I've been dancing with. So I'm deeply humbled and grateful. And with, I guess, something that you had spoken about, and I'd love to get to know, because I'm sure some people who are listening may be like, I don't know if that's for me or not. Who is this for? One, what are some of the commonalities that you see people that prevents them from really capturing the moment? And two, we were talking about this a little bit earlier, but what can some people expect from going through the process with you guys?
Lots to unpack there. Who's this for? I think you know when it's for you. I think it's very clear. If you're listening right now and you check in and you think, am I holding back when I speak? Or if you think what Kaveh just described seems like an absolute nightmare to me, being called and having to walk up on a stage and speak in front of others seems like hell. Or I could probably do it, but I would hate every second of it. And I would go down and I would be completely spent, have no energy left, and just want to go home and huddle in a corner. Then this is for you. Because what I love about what we do is that it's much less skill acquisition than it is unlearning the stories we have created for ourselves. We're working with the CEO of a company this morning who's giving a big speech this Saturday. And we've been working with him for a while. He came to us describing, you know, speaking as his handicap. And he's created a huge company. This guy is incredibly successful, hides it phenomenally well because as the CEO, he can always throw the ball, pass the puck to someone else. But for the first time this morning, we saw a completely different version of him, where he was almost no different from how he was when he spoke to us before and after giving his mock speech, which is very, very, which basically never happened with him. And so we asked him a little bit, like, what unlocked? Why are you so fluid now and not mechanical? And his biggest realization was, I used to think there was, it's so freeing because I thought there was a way I was supposed to be. I thought that public speaking had rules and that you're supposed to do it in a certain way. And now I realize that that's not at all what it's about. And that's what drives me to do this every day. What makes me so excited to bring this to people is that public speaking is no different than speaking. If you take the public out of it, that's what this is about. And what speaking is just self-expression. It's just relearning, taking out the stories and relearning what it feels like to be yourself, to be present, to be in flow, to be channeling something as you speak. Because we all know how to speak. Everybody knows how to speak. And that's so amazing when you think about it. We have people come into a room and they all think they have an issue with speaking. They all think they're not good at it. They all think they all have, you know, low self-esteem when it comes to that. And within a few hours, they all look like natural speakers. They're standing up there and they're expressing themselves and they're having a blast. And they're like, I can't teach you, you know, Joseph Fruchek, who we're with from Fighting Monkey. This world-class movement coach talks about that all the time. He says, I can't teach you anything in 3 days. It's not possible. So I can only show you the road or give you a mirror or something. Yet we see it day after day after day. A person showing up looking like a terrible speaker, right? Like somebody who's wearing shackles. And then half an hour, 40 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later, looking unleashed. Unlocked. That's not because we added skill. That's just because we took stuff away that was limiting them. And I think that's, you know, that's why our game is called Speak Before You Think, because we have to short circuit the brain. We have to short circuit the thinking brain, because when you think about what it's like to have a good time speaking, you have to think back to, when was the last time I was super excited about a topic and sharing it with my best friend, my partner, anybody? Like, when you're in that space where you're just speaking excitedly, there is no place for thinking, right? There's no, you're not thinking about what you're saying from afar and judging it. You're just channeling an emotion and building it as you go. And that's what we're looking for. Yet, so many people think that it should look a certain way, or there are very specific rules. And if you're trying to achieve that, if you're trying to look a certain way or hit certain rules, then you have to be in your mind. You have to be very conscious as you're speaking, which is the opposite of what speaking really is about. Can you remind me what the last question was? If you remember.
Well, I learned in this process that I'm probably just going to ask one question at a time. But I thought also that there'd be a potential to, like, it encapsulates all of the lessons into one. Mm-hmm. But I feel like that was a beautiful share in and of itself. And when you're saying about the thinking mind is processing on behalf of survival first. But we're in a time where we're safe from food, we're safe from predators, we're safe with shelter, we're safe with all the basic necessities that we need to really survive. So we're in letting the ego know that we are surviving, but we want to thrive. This type of tool forces the hand of the ego to allow us to thrive, because what ends up coming is, first, it's curiosity of, can I trust myself to actually speak? Because I've been speaking so many places, but now I'm trusting myself a little more. And then this, it becomes sequential. As the nourishment of these experiences becomes more and more digested, the trust instills itself. And now I know I can survive in a public speaking arena as well. And now you can become conscious about what you're saying at the same time too, but the barriers that were preventing from it, that thought it was helping you survive, doesn't need to show up the same way. So it's very interesting that you guys dance with that.
And I mean, that's one of the most rewarding things in what we do is, as you're saying, it's so interlinked to everything else in your life. Whatever is holding you back in your self-expression is holding you back everywhere else in your life, right? So when you unlock that, your whole life starts opening up, right? We have clients who call us up and say, like, I'm showing up, my children are noticing this, my husband is noticing this, my employees are noticing this. Suddenly people are doing things that are almost unlike them from the outside of like, wow, I wouldn't have expected that of you. You know, we're working with one client in San Francisco who showed up in a meeting and just started cracking joke after joke after joke. And they were probably so stunned to see that because she'd been showing up the opposite way. And so you might think, wow, I didn't like, who is that person that's showing up? But who it really is the person who's was there the whole time. And finally, I feel safe enough to let that person show. And wow, the reception you get when you start doing that is phenomenal. And then as you did in your call with Aubrey, right, it starts unlocking so many other opportunities, right? Like with this unlocked, and what else can I unlock in my life?
That's so beautiful. If I were to put it into three words, I would say expressive barrier dissolution. And that's what your guys' process actually seems to be doing, because the barrier dissolves in trust and then allows the most important portion, which is presence, to be felt there. And now this part, this client that you had was able to go from behind the barrier where she's on the sidelines, and now she's able to, that barrier as it comes down, able to show up in what's more likely her truth. And this presence that she's able to have is allowed to express itself more in what people would call authentic. You know, when people saying their authentic truth, I feel like at times when we think we're living an authentic or self-driven life, we've created our life in such a way where we've protected ourselves in very intelligently formulated ways where we don't have to be re-triggered with the barriers that bring us into challenge. Like if I was obligated to go and be underwater every day I think there would be a very discomforting feeling that would be showing up every morning with this barrier that I'd be approaching until that barrier gains trust. And your guys' process is so beautiful for doing that. And I can speak to in March, this again, we were there for 2 days, I believe 3 days actually. And on the first day, I had been going through a separation and it had been a month, but my ex-partner had gone away on a trip to Mexico and we were still in communication. But just before that, the communication had become very stagnant and I had not fully processed the relationship. I actually hadn't, a conversation with Mike actually regarding rock bottom, which is something separate, was a really big catalyst for resolving that. But I knew that the best lesson, I would be able to receive the greatest lessons experientially from you guys if I went before I spoke to her in the afternoon. So I did not look at my phone and I had a beautiful experience and I felt incredibly immersed and able to express myself in this story of myself that was really well received by everyone, but also I felt it in the morning. And then at 12 o'clock, I went and looked at my phone when I invited everyone not to look at their phone during the entire weekend. And I saw some things that were very challenging and I was not able to get out of my own way. And if you recall, my afternoon sessions were very challenging for me to be present for. So maybe you could talk to me a little bit about that, because I think a lot of people show up that way where their barriers are so overbearing that they have a big difficulty coming out of it. And have you met people in the past, I guess, who are clients, colleagues, what are the words? You're a human, I'm a human. So someone who shows up wanting to work with you, and the most difficult person or experience that's come there and they felt like there's absolutely no way that I can show up. What tools have you used to really help them break through that you can speak to the human if there's something that you can resolve?
It's like what's a good analogy for this, for what it feels like? It's like you're, you know, if you've ever played Jenga and you're setting the Jenga back up, but every time you put something down, it shifts. Like it's ever moving. It's always, so you always have to put something in a different place to recreate the balance in a way. So we walk into a session with our toolkit, right? Everything we've created up to this point, and that's all we have. And it's a beautiful analogy to what it's like to speak, really, under pressure. You only have one shot. You can't add any skills in that moment, right? So how do I make the most of everything I have in this moment? And the only way to do that is to be hyper-present and to trust that listening to your intuition and going with the flow and trusting that you have it, the right things are going to come up, and that it's just as balance is not like little by little inching up to the place of balance, is taking a step a little bit too far then coming back, a little bit too far then coming back to a little, right, retreating back until you find the balance. That's what it feels like to be coaching to me, is we're in there and we're going to play all kinds of games. The first thing, really the foundation of it all, is playfulness. Mm-hmm. Without a doubt.
I love that.
If there is no play in this, you will never enjoy it. If you're not going to enjoy it, you'll never want to do it again, right? So the first thing I want to do is get the person in front of me to sense the possibility. I want them to yearn for what's behind that. So we do put a little bit of challenge in there. You know, if somebody's really stressed out and says, it's so hard for me to speak, then we'll say, okay, and we'll ask them a question or give them a speech title and put a timer for 3 minutes and say, the only rule is you have to speak until the timer goes off. Mm-hmm. For some people, it's very, very, very challenging. So, but from there, they're gonna sense what's possible. And then we're going to start playing all kinds of games. And really, these are games, you know, I gifted the game to a friend who's very recently sent me a picture of him playing with his kids, like a 9-year-old and a 13-year-old, and having a blast. Like, these are games that can be taken just as pure games. It's a card game, right? But at the same time, there's so much that is shown through every single exercise. So what we're trying to do, at least how I see it, is to get the person who's struggling to experience something completely new. Is it safe to speak about psychedelics on this podcast?
I'd say so, yeah.
Okay.
We're not admitting to anything.
The way I see a psychedelic journey is an opening of possibility. So if you enter a journey, suddenly you're sent to a place of what is possible. And I think it's very tempting to, it's like you're setting a stake way far out of like, oh my goodness, I never realized that this was attainable, but now it is. Now I've experienced it once. How do I get back there? Now the trap is to take psychedelics again 1,000 times to go back there, but that doesn't work, and you build tolerance. You know, there are 100,000 reasons not to do that. The real secret is, well, how do I, through my life, now build a practice that's going to lead me to this place that I now know exists because I've experienced it for myself? It's the same approach that I have when we're coaching. How can I get this person by any means possible? You know, this client in particular was having a lot of trouble bringing playfulness to this. She's in a very corporate world, and it's very difficult. It was very difficult for her to even consider bringing play to this world. That's, in her mind, a very Cartesian mind. There's no way that, you know, 1 + 1 = 3. I don't need playfulness here. I need to be more effective. I need to be XYZ. And at one point we sat down and I said, okay, I want us to be so silly through these games. I want us to go so far that at one point someone's going to say, okay, guys, let's get back to work. Like, this is not okay. We have to get back to work. That's what I was looking for in this case. And to a certain extent, it's the same thing with everyone. How can I get you to that place where you can put the stake out there and say, like, I want to get back to there? Because that felt better than it's ever felt in my life. I didn't know it was possible that I could, I didn't know I could reach out so far with that stake. And then we play a very different game of like, now how do we put the reps in? How do we build in the different steps in the real world to be able to go back to that place over and over and over until that becomes the new normal?
Beautifully said. And I love the analogy that you do intermingle with psychedelics, because in the communities that we tend to see ourselves showing up among, there is a tendency to reach for psychedelics. But I am of the same family as you in that they are just, they are beautiful mediums that worked in medicine, they say an adjunct, in addition to the other processes that you're using to get from point A to point B and enjoy the journey at the same time too. And what I love is that it takes awareness to recognize that, and it maybe was on my 20th or 30th experience, of which I'm not saying what in particular, to realize that I don't have to go there, and these are beautiful, but they are beautiful markers to let me know what does exist and I can tap into here. And then more and more the clarity came into, if I'm stepping into ceremonies to have this type of experience, can life be the ceremony? Wait, is life the ceremony? Life is the ceremony. And I was taking medicine to have this awareness be seen, and it's, I call it portals, like to show us that there is this other thing that's available. Can life be the medicine? Wait, life is the medicine. Life is medicine. And there's a cathartic moment that is, it brings a pause in your experience where you're just digesting the awe of the reality. And what you guys tap into very often, which really hammers stories home, is the pause. And I see this in so many artistic expressions in songs where it goes dead silent after a really big buildup. And that silence just hooks you in a very interesting way. And if I could slightly divert to asking you, one of the biggest things that I had spoken to you guys about earlier was recognizing what life was like before and then life was like after. And there's a moment before and then after where we are on this one-way path where we can't unsee this experience that we have, and now we have this certain affinity for life that we didn't have before. Do you know what that moment was where you came off of the autopilot and you started living this life that was more intentional? Like, was there a Tristan before that you can associate with and then remember? Like, for example, myself was with a tumor when I was 19 years old. I got misdiagnosed 3 times. And then I, in experiencing 100 ways that I was going to be dying with things incomplete, I felt my impermanence and how life is finite, and it brought this humility to the experience of what life is. And I felt a lot more intentionality being dabbled in more and more into my life, and this is the experience 12 years later, 13 now that my birthday was 2 days ago. Do you have an experience that was similar, not but in your own way, where there was before and then there was that moment and then we are here now?
When I think about that question, it's hard for me to pull one specific moment out, like the big before and after. What I do notice is that there were many, multiple at least, true key moments in my life that completely changed the direction of my life. The first of which was the day I moved from the US to France. I was 10 years old, and suddenly, very, very suddenly, at least that's how it felt like in my 10-year-old mind, I was told, you're going to leave everything you know and love behind, and we're going to move to this new foreign country. My mother's French. I spoke French, although with an accent, and I'd been to France multiple times. But for me, I did not feel much affinity with France. I felt much more American at the time, although now maybe I feel a little bit more French than American, hard to say. But the big insight for me was showing up there, and my parents, for some reason, chose to put me in a very, very, very conventional school, a big school, 5 or 6 classes per level, and very Catholic and like extraordinarily conventional, like basically the opposite of what I was in the US. And I went from being a very normal average kid. Like I wasn't never part of the cool kids, but I was far away from being part of the uncool kids. I was just like in the middle and fine. And I was very comfortable with who I was as much as you can be when you're 10. And suddenly I'm thrown into this new world and I'm the weird kid overnight. Overnight, people are making fun of me. People are making fun of my accent. People are calling me names and I'm unfamiliar with the conventions. I'm unfamiliar with what is normal and how to navigate this. And it's taking me so much energy just to go through a normal day. And I'm scared in my apartment because now I don't live in a house. I live in an apartment and there are other people next door that I can hear them at night and I'm freaking out and I'm not sleeping well. But more than anything, I had this crazy internal realization or dialogue that why don't these people see me for who I am? I am not the person they think I am. I'm like them. I'm just like them. There's no difference. Why don't they see it? And so I don't know why I had that level of, I don't know what it was, if it was awareness or confidence. It might have came from my background in sports. I was doing a lot of martial arts and I was pretty good at it. So I think I had confidence somewhere else. I wasn't solely relying on that. But that was the first time that something giant switched in my brain. And from then on, I was part of all the groups. I never wanted to be part of a group. I never wanted to be that person who was, you know, calling other people names. So I was friends with the most rejected person all my life. And every class, everything, I would be friends with the person nobody wanted to be friends with. And people made fun of me for that, mm-hmm. but I was totally fine with that. But I was also friends with the coolest kids, right? I was the person who navigated, because in that moment, I realized everybody's the same. Everybody's the same. And I was lucky enough to be in environments where people had money and environments where people had no money at all. And regardless of the environment I was in, I was noticing the same dialogues. They're saying the same things about the other people. If they're on top or on the bottom, on the side, on the left, on the right, doesn't matter. Everybody's saying the same thing. Everybody's feeling the same thing. And suddenly I realized, oh my God, everybody is the same. That definitely sent me on a completely different road. There are other moments where I remember a very specific moment where a friend of mine allowed me to dream 100 times bigger than I'd ever dreamt. And that was my start into entrepreneurship. So that was my start into intentionally leading my life. Like that's the moment that defined me never getting a normal job. And there might be other moments along the way, but I think that one, the 10-year-old one is the biggest one of all.
Well, before I speak to that, do you think you could share a little bit what that means, like to dream 100 times more?
Yeah, absolutely. I think particularly if you're brought up in a little bit more of a conventional world, and, you know, if your parents aren't entrepreneurs or artists or creatives or people who have integrated in their lives habituated themselves to see rules as suggestions and to break them as part of the creative process and to look at their environment through the lens of, hey, what if I took it this way or that way, regardless of how other people are doing it, which was my case. My father wasn't the same. He was very creative in his job, but he did 30 years in the same exact job. My mother, for most of her life, was a stay-at-home mom, although she did a lot of other projects. But in a way, they were very risk-averse and conventional in that sense. And in my school, it was the same thing. So all my environment was that way. Mm. I thought in a very linear way, and I thought there was no other way of thinking. I was a master's in computer engineering just because I didn't want to close any doors. And I knew that if I did that, I could do anything I wanted. I could go and be an artist or, you know, a writer or whatever it was, even though that was not part of it. Or I could be a developer. I didn't know. I had no idea. I didn't even truly understand what entrepreneurship was. Who was I to think I could start a company like that? Truly, genuinely had not even went through my mind. Mm-hmm. Although when I look back, I notice many, many instances in my life where I was pulled in that direction, but then kind of subdued by my mm-hmm. parents or people around me. And I'm sitting down in this school cafeteria and my friend's in front of me, this new friend, and he starts talking about a few things and we get to go-karting. And I was like, oh man, that's something I've always wanted to do. And he's like, oh my God, you haven't gone go-karting? Dude, we have to go go-karting together. And I'm like, done, deal. Like, I'm excited. And then he says, actually, you know, we should get a bunch of friends and try to do something. You know, maybe we could get a bunch of friends and go go-karting together. And I'm like, oh, that's cool. I hadn't thought of it that way. Sure. And then he said, or we could go go-karting for free. And I'm like, what do you mean go-karting for free? He's like, well, what if we built a little event and we got a bunch of people to sign up and we could like rent the place for, you know, a certain amount and then just get people to pay enough that it covers the, and then we go go-karting for free. And like that moment, my brain just melted. And I was like, what are you talking about right now? Are you serious? But it didn't end there. The conversation, every time my brain melted, he'd add to it. And he's like, well, what if we made money with this? And I'm like, what do you mean? What if we made money? And he's like, well, let's make it even bigger. Let's rent the thing for a whole evening and let's get like 200 people to come and we'll organize a giant race and we'll have music and we'll have this and that. And then I'm like, I'm still in the cafeteria and like 15 minutes before this, my life was normal. And suddenly this guy has planted this seed of possibility in my brain and I'm seeing the world completely because I'm living it with him. I'm living it, but I keep coming back to the present and looking around and I'm in a shitty cafeteria thinking, I don't understand what's happening. Why am I over there and here at the same time? And then he says, dude, this is what we should do. We have to make a race in the city. We're going to block off roads. This has really happened. First time I talk about this to this guy, we started, let's go go-karting. An hour later, we're going to block off roads in the middle of the city and we're going to build a race there and we're going to get sponsors and it's going to be like amazing. And that day marked the beginning of at first I was like, you're crazy, right? This is not possible. You're crazy. And then he shared that he'd done a few of those things already in a much smaller way, but he'd done some of it. And he showed me like some of the videos from the things he'd done. And, you know, 3 months later, we had 70 people at a race that we organized and I'm racing for free and I'm go-karting more than I ever had in my life. And I'm enjoying as much the process of creating this whole thing as I am enjoying the go-karting. And a year later, we have a team of 10 people and we're doing 200 pilots per race a whole evening. And we're like doing pit stops, gas, like it's 2.5 hours. A year later, we're doing a 24-hour race that costs tens of thousands of dollars that's entirely paid for by this thing that we created. And then we're still students. And a year later, I'm in Spain doing my an internship. And he calls me up and he's like, you won't believe what's happening. I just talked to the mayor of one of the cities right next to Paris. And he's interested in doing a race inside the city. Like I've sold this to him. And 6 months later, I'm back and we're working on this thing. And we have Honda who's talking about sponsoring us. And we're working with the French, Automobile Federation, like the race the federation, and working on permits and everything. And that one didn't happen, but we got to a month before, a month and a half, where Honda finally, which was our main sponsor, pulled out to divert their money, into a sailing race. And so we called it on that moment, but basically that thing was happening. And all of this happened in that one conversation. So not only was it a conversation that challenged my reality, my perception of reality, of I can actually dream this, I'm allowed to dream this big. And it became a practice of ours, an intentional practice. But he proved to me that we could make all of these happen afterwards, that it actually wasn't just crazy dreams, that it was something we could do. And that, without a doubt, set me on a entirely different course for my life.
That's why I asked, why are you, at the start? Mm-hmm. Because there are these defining moments in our experiences of life that are as beautiful as that I didn't stop smiling while you were sharing that story, because it taps into the childness, which was able to dance with the person that sits in front of me right now. And I see where the creative process and where his capacity to think, not in the form of rules or agreements, but in suggestions, which now makes a lot more sense to how a curious mind continues to explore. Because Joseph from Fighting Monkey gave us the differentiation between exploring and exploiting. And he said, when you know, you begin to exploit. And that's because now you know that this is the only island that you can live on. So now you must excavate everything here. Whereas the explorer says, I'm on this island, I'm curious about the rest. And then you get to realize that, you know what, we can inhabit almost every island and there's no real barriers that exist. And if there's usually a human there that you can interact with, and with your humanness, open their humanness back up too. Had you ever asked when you were in France, why do these people not see me for who I am, when you were in the US? Because this is the beauty of coming off of the autopilot, is because we live a certain way and we habituate very nicely. But then when you're put into a new environment, the contrast is so strong and prevalent and a threat to our survival that we start asking these existential questions that bring this beautiful insight. And this 10-year-old child was welcomed into by the muse almost to reflect on a question that is profound, that maybe some people ask when they're 30, 40, and people may feel and get blended into when they're 15, 20, but you asked and you came to a beautiful conclusion. And I feel your humility and your kindness and gentleness that you have with humans, and that I can see that could be one of your early experiences that you had. So thank you for sharing that. What does it feel like on this side of the autopilot? On this side of life outside of the autopilot? Like how does your experience of life feel? Because you were able to speak about your client right now who's able to show up with her colleagues and she has this playfulness. What does playfulness look like for you in the real world outside of Speak Before You Think?
I have to pause for a second and say that I am so happy for the world that you are doing this podcast, because you have one of the most amazing brains I have ever had the privilege to encounter. I've told you many times, I'm going to tell you again, we almost got to the point where you had to put explicit on your your podcast. Maybe it'll happen, but if you're listening to this, forget about me, it doesn't matter, but sign up, find a way to subscribe to this, because there are not many Kaveh's in the world, and you guys are really, really lucky that he's putting it out there. So thank you, first of all.
I receive. Thank you.
I'm getting almost shivers in my body. Like my hair's standing up just thinking about this, and thinking about how important it is in my life, and how healing it is, and more than anything, I think how natural it is. And, you know, Joseph always talks about coming back to nature. He's hilarious in how easily he'll destroy any other practice or anything that is not found in nature, right? A lot of the, what people do right now is in isolation. And he says, show me something. That's a bad accent, but show me something that works in isolation in nature. It doesn't exist. Show it to me. Find me anything that works in isolation. Does not exist. Why do you want to isolate anything? And when I think about play, you know, the most intelligent species all have play at the center of their dynamic. And I think a lot of people around me see me as very playful and enjoy that side of me because it's so prevalent in how I am and how I like to approach life. I find as much lightness as I find insight in play. It's rejuvenating, regenerating. And I play in 1,000 different ways. You know, I'll play as much in like verbal jousting with trying to get jokes out and failing miserably, or, you know, playing with my kid in card games or trying to play with his mind. But in my previous house, I had a slack line in the middle of my yard, you know, and anybody who'd come to my house would end up on the slack line, and I'd trying to help them learn this thing that seems impossible when you try it for the first time, and trying to bring play to that. Life on the other side of the autopilot is true liberation, right? It's freedom, it's lightness, it's everything you could imagine it would be. But it's also, if you're going to play outside of the autopilot, you got to be paying attention, right? If you're driving in your Tesla and the autopilot's on, you can put a soft focus on, right? When you take it off, you better be paying attention, otherwise you're going to hit one of the rails or a car by your side. So there's a cost that I'm very, very willing to pay, but there definitely is a cost. And even if you're working for yourself, you suddenly can do anything you want with your life, but that means you can waste it. That means you can lose intentionality. That means you can not be present very, very easily. And so I think that we should all be trying to find if we are or not in autopilot, and then finding a way to stay in it. Mm-hmm. Right? Life wants to pull you back. Inertia wants to slowly bring you out of it and back into life, into the grind of life.
Mm-hmm. And in that's beautifully said, and I resonate deeply with the concept of play there, because on the other side of it feels like 31 or 32 years of seriousness that I was existing in, and that I feel like we all do exist in. But when you're able to step outside of what seriousness even means, what actually is serious? I work in the emergency room, and I feel like when someone is imminently going to pass or have a severe traumatic, emotional, physical, psychological experience, there is an element of seriousness that exists there that I would like to intervene in. Whereas taxes, we perceive as serious, but they're not. Making work on time, we perceive as serious, but it's not really. Can we find, how would you invite people who perceive the world as serious in so many respects into a world that is more playful? And it's not a point A, point B, as far as I see it, but how would you invite someone in to start getting curious about the journey to just recognizing that there are serious things, but life is play?
I don't know. I can say that just this morning, I got a text message from my sister because one of our friend's son, who's 17 years old, was walking back home after going climbing with his 7-year-old brother. They were about to go play soccer. Suddenly he said, "My head hurts," started throwing up, and right now he's in a coma in an instant. And this was hours ago. I have two kids, and I wouldn't even dare trying to imagine what that is. I would not dare send my brain there. I don't want any of those neural pathways to exist, because just the from afar, just even beginning to think about what that could be is close to traumatizing. And so when I think about that, what matters? Nothing matters. Nothing. Like, what would you give to spend another 30 seconds even to know that it would potentially end there? What would you give to spend those? How would you spend those 5 minutes differently? Does it matter that your boss is mad at you? Does it matter does anything matter? No. So I do think it starts there. You know, I have this conversation with my wife a lot about the distinction between urgent and important, for example, you know, and so many times we think something is, we confuse urgent with important, or important with urgent. So suddenly this thing has to happen now. No, it doesn't. It's important, but it's not really urgent. And it really doesn't matter if it happens right now in 5 minutes or tomorrow, or it never even happens most of the time. So I think, I mean, I don't have a great answer for that, but I know that the way I like to think about it is to challenge what my autopilot beliefs are, right? When I have this sense of, oh, this is really important. Oh, I have to look good. I have to look a certain way. Or as soon as something crosses my mind that I notice is automatic and is something that everybody else is thinking, I like to challenge that. And maybe the way to enter play, more playfulness in your world, is what if everything was a game? So I like to say that in our teaching, we like to exaggerate anything to make it stick, to feel it. So that might be my recommendation, is just if you want to bring play to your life and it's not there, or you want more play, exaggerate it, overdo it for a little bit. Because again, balance, you don't inch your way towards balance. You have to go a little bit too far and then come back. If you've ever done or tried a handstand, you know exactly what that is. From afar, it looks stable. The person in the handstand is constantly rebalancing back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth, back, forth. That's the only way to create balance. And I think that's what it's all about. If you want to find the right balance for play, go too far.
Wow, that was beautiful. And I would invite, if there were two choices between living life seriously or living life seeing it as an opportunity for us to dance, for us to play, if there was a choice between the two, I would absolutely take play and dance, as you seem to be doing masterfully.
Play and dance.
Yeah. And I know that we're running short on time. You guys have another client coming up. So I wanted to thank you very much for spending the time to share your wisdom.
It's,
and I look forward.
Honor, absolute honor to be guest number one. Am I guest number one?
You're guest number one.
This is, I can't tell you how honored I am to be a little insignificant blip, but the starter point of something that I have no doubt will bring lots of value to the world. I'm very happy you're opening your brain to the world right now.
Thank you very much for those words. If there's one thing, as you asked me in a voice note yesterday, if there's one invitation that you could have for me to take Tristan along the way on my journey, but for the listeners as well, what would that one thing be?
Well, I have two things that come to mind, but the first one, I think you're doing very, very well right now. But it's the insight that I had when I was 10. everybody's the same. If you meet someone who seems to know it all, he's exactly like you. He's thinking like you. He's questioning everything. He's unsure of everything. If you don't have a lot of money and are impressed by people who have a lot of money, no different. Same thing. Vice versa, if you have a lot of money or social status and you look at people who don't and you think it's different, it's not different. Everybody is the same. And when you start seeing the world that way, you get to connect on a completely different level individually. And there's so much magic in there. But I do think you do that remarkably well. So, I mean, I think ending on play would be the place to be. Like, how can you be the silliest? How can you turn something that looks a little bit serious into play? And there's so much magic there. I just heard a question from, I think it was Naval Ravikant, who said, what looks like play to you, or feels like play to you, but looks like work to others? In a world of infinite leverage, that's where success lies.
That's lovely. And there was power in that pause. That 20, 30 second pause was able to bring insight for me to wrap this whole moment in, this expression, and it hammered home the power of pause and what it can bring, the deep insight that it brought that you shared with us. So thank you.
Thank you
very much, Tristan. Awesome. And I look forward to seeing you again, brother.
I want to thank my guests for taking the time to share their insights and wisdom. Please consider connecting with them, and their information will be in the show notes. Consider leaving a review and rating the podcast. I'm not going to tell you what to rate. You do as you feel. And please, before this podcast ends and you go on to the next thing, take 3 to 5 minutes in silence to allow some of the information that you heard to be contemplated, digested, and integrated. To the degree that every experience has a moment to actually have it be processed, it has a greater chance for it to be instilled into your life. I wish the rest of your day and week is beautiful. Take care, remain curious, and don't forget to play.